Hello and welcome in.
First science. Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. Modern geology has moved on somewhat from the safari suit-wearing, hammer-wielding, intrepid explorers of the past. In fact, the scientists of today use sonar, seismometry, and advanced computer modeling to crack open the planet we live on and peer inside. My guest this week is an expert in just these kind of advances. Professor Chris Jackson is a geologist and professor of basin analysis at the Department of Earth Science and Engineering at Imperial College London, where he studies sedimentary basins, salt tectonics, and subsurface processes. Welcome, Chris.
Hello. Hi.
It's good to have you on. Were you always into geology, or, you know, as a kid, were you collecting fossils, or did you kind of come to this later?
I think probably every kid collects fossils, maybe under duress on family holidays. A little bit. I mean, I grew up in Derbyshire, so I spent quite a lot of time in the hills around there, actually, where there's a lot of Carboniferous rock, very old rock there. So maybe I was kind of like by osmosis, I was taking it in without actually being aware that it's something you could do for research and actually study.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, I was definitely one of those kids who would go along and look at fossils, pretend I'd found fossils that were in fact just, you know, I don't know,
cement.
Yeah, exactly. A bit of glass that had been washed up on a pair, something like that. So, right, before we dive right into the proper science, we're going to have a brain teaser. And today's brain teaser is: this object has holes in its top and bottom, sides and insides. Despite this, it can still hold water. What am I? So that's: this object has holes in its top and bottom, sides and insides. Despite this, it can still hold water. What am I? So if you think you know the answer, do get in touch with us at Science Mixtape, and maybe you'll get a shout out at the end of the show. So Chris, we're going to start with your first song, and you've chosen The Cribs with Bovine Republic. Why did you choose this one?
I like rock music. I like all music, as my music choices will probably indicate. I particularly like The Cribs because it just feels quite raw and thrashy. And also, I love the fact that they kind of don't disguise their accents. They're from Huddersfield. So I quite like music where people don't kind of Americanize it. They just sing like they want to sing.
Well, here it is. Did they cut up kids' shoes? Did they cut wear brown shoes? Did they sell out ever after read about this in the news? You're gonna have a go. Well, I don't want to know. I just thought that I should try and say hello to those who never exist without seasonality. Right to impress. I'd go right for, but you'd never exist if you wasn't generic. You'd right to impress. I'd go right for, but I'll never forget how all this began, and I will never regret a thing I have done. But you would never exist without a story. Maybe I've been a half the time, fair weather friends of mine. A year's a long time, you're doing nothing with your life. I heard you felt alert. Oh, I'm hoping that it hurts, cause we spent too much time in grammar to be grinding to the curb. I don't want to never exist without being genetic. You're out to impress. I'll fall right home, but you never exist if you want genetic. The Earth consists of four concentric layers: inner core, outer core, mantle, and crust. The crust is about 0 to 60 kilometers thick and is made up of tectonic plates during constant motion. So that was our first fact for the day. And so, Chris, back to basics, right? As a kid, I learned there are basically three types of rocks, right? Do you study one in particular, or do you do them all at once?
I started off by mainly studying sedimentary rocks. So they're rocks made from bits of other rocks. So they can be bits of metamorphic and igneous rocks, which are the other two rock types. So the sedimentary, metamorphic, and igneous. So I used to study mainly sedimentary rocks, so sandstones, mudstones, limestones. And more recently, though, I started working quite a bit more on igneous rocks. So these are rocks that are formed through the melting of other rocks.
Right.
So they can be formed through the melting of the sedimentary or the metamorphic rocks. So we have this thing called the rock cycle, right? So mm-hmm. The rocks and the fragments derived from their erosion are continuously being moved around the earth, buried, melted, squashed, squeezed. So often when you try and study one, you find yourself looking at lots of others.
They're just all there. That's the problem.
They're all there. And also one gives rise to another one. And trying to understand that is one thing that I do, and lots of other geologists do as well, other scientists.
So you started off just looking at these sedimentary rocks. Do you,
do you have like a way of imagining the kind of formations you're looking at, and what's the best way of thinking about these?
So often with sedimentary geology, so this is understanding how landforms form and how rivers formed in the ancient past and beaches. One of the best ways is actually to look at something like Google Earth.
All right.
Is actually to try and get a sense of the scale and the processes that actually laid down that rock, right? Because from the rock you're trying to infer how that rock was made by what processes on Earth. But actually you can go and look at modern processes, and you can take a walk on the beach, or you could look at Google Earth and actually get a really good sense. So it's a really simple way, I think, of communicating to people how these ancient landscapes and ancient rocks kind of came to be, or in the future they'll be formed by the current processes on Earth.
So I mean, these rock formations that you're talking about, they're big in scale, like hundreds of meters or maybe kilometers.
More than that, several tens of kilometers, hundreds of kilometers. Rock layers go on for a long, long way.
And what kind of timescales are we thinking about, like for the formation of these kind of layers that you're looking at?
Yeah, it's a good question. Some rocks are formed very quickly, so some igneous rocks might be in place kind of instantaneously, or over a few thousand of years. Whereas a very thin layer of mudstone, because the sedimentation rate is very low, you can have tens of millions of years captured in a meter of rock. So the scales are just wildly different for different dimensions of rock.
Right, it really spans the whole, all the way back to kind of the beginning of the Earth,
days to hundreds of millions of years, So some of the metamorphic rocks have taken many, many millions of years to be squashed, squeezed, buried, and then exhumed and available for us to study at the Earth's surface today.
So there's all these different rocks. They're all on kind of different length scales and different time scales. Is there a subject that you're particularly interested in within that? And how would you describe it?
So I'm a basin analyst.
Right.
So not, like, often raises a smile. So not hand basins, but sedimentary basins. So I'm very interested in how the Earth's crust is deformed. So when we stretch the crust, we create rift valleys. And when we squash the crust, we create mountains. So I'm interested in how the timescales and lengthscales of those processes, and then particularly how sediment is eroded from those landscapes and transported around them and deposited on them. So how we use the sedimentary record to understand how the Earth is built.
Right. And that can go all the way down, tens of kilometers underneath the Earth.
In fact, a lot of the rich record of those processes is preserved beneath our feet, so we have to use a series of techniques to get at that.
All right. Yeah, so I think a little bit later we're going to talk about kind of some of these ways that you actually find of looking under the rock, which are quite fascinating. But are there formations that people can actually see that are an advantage of that? Is there any kind of famous examples of this kind of sedimentary rock?
Yeah, go to the Jurassic coast on the south coast of England. The very famous layers, the Ammonites in the Jurassic. People have probably been dragged there on family holidays enough times.
Been dragged there as a kid, just outside Bristol, going on lots of. You can look for fossils. Go and play.
Exactly. If you go to the Suspension Bridge, there's a stunning Carboniferous limestone exposures beneath Clifton Suspension Bridge.
Yeah, it's that huge sheet which you just see all the
and people climbing on it. Yep, there's amazing sort of record of all the animals that lived in those ancient seas are all there. So we've seen, a lot of people have seen geology. You kind of ask the question, is there formation we can see? But we've all probably been walking around it and on holiday and seen it all the time, and maybe we're just not looking at it in the same way.
Yeah, even just like the Earth is a different colour, the rocks are different colours when you're walking around. Obviously, this is just examples of
landscape, land use. The reason we have certain soils and we can grow certain things is all dictated by the geology. So all of that is there. We all see it every day.
So do you have like a pet formation that's like your favourite, you're really interested in?
Oh, I don't know, maybe my heart is still attached to my PhD study area, the rocks there.
Was
in the Gulf of Suez in Sinai in Egypt.
Oh, really? So what were you looking at there?
I was looking at the rifting. So the rifting, which is breaking up East Africa, propagates, kind of continues northwards into the Red Sea.
Yeah.
And I was working at the north bit of that, looking at how the Earth's crust was being split and how the rocks deposited during that process kind of recorded that. So all those rocks mean a lot to me. I kind of loved it, but I hated it at the same time because my PhD thesis was on it.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a love-hate relationship there when you spend quite so long on something that then no one never reads. But hey, that's part of being a scientist. Let's go on to your second song. You've chosen Gabriel by Joe Goddard. Why did you choose this one?
Massive Hot Chip fan. And I just love the melodic nature of the tunes, particularly Gabriel I Like by Joe Goddard in his solo project, just because of the bass line. Just, there's nothing wrong with it at all.
Well, there you go. This is Gabriel by Joe Goddard. Six of the major tectonic plates are named for the continents embedded within them, such as the North American, African, and Antarctic plates. There's our second fact. Unfortunately, you know, we got a little bit of the tectonic plate fact theme for the beginning of it, but I'm going to go back to what we were talking about before, Chris, which is one of the big problems I can see with the kind of work is it's quite hard to see these things you're studying, right? How do you get around that? What kind of things are you looking for when you do, say, field work?
Yeah. So when we're doing field work, one of the real benefits of field work is we can get up close and personal with the rocks. So we can go and look at them in a lot of detail. We can collect samples. We can look at things microscopically as well. So, you know, we can get lots of detailed information over the length scale and the time scale afforded by an outcrop. So an outcrop of rock could be quite small, but we could get quite a lot of detail from that if we were to do petrographic work, so look at it under a microscope.
This is like looking at the, seeing what kind of minerals are in it and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. The texture of the rock, what that tells us about the processes depositing that rock, where the rock came from actually in sedimentary rocks, because often they'll contain a mineral suite which is indicative of the fact it came from a granitic mountain, or it came from a igneous or like a igneous kind of plateau somewhere.
Right, okay.
So yeah, we can use the outcrop geology for that, but it's limited in scale often, which is why we can use other techniques to try and look at things on a bigger scale.
Right. Okay. So you're when you're going out and you're doing these expeditions, what kind of stuff do you do? Do you just go and travel there and stay there for a month, or is this like a day trip, or like does it work?
It can vary. Depends on the scientific question you're asking, right? So if you want to kind of understand something very detailed about the geochemistry coming from a particular signature from a particular rock, you could go out there, spend a day, maybe just sample that rock, because the bigger geological context is known and all you really care about is a particular geochemical analyses on a particular very small bit of rock. So
right.
It's a day. Whereas if you're going to go and do a big field campaign where you're trying to unravel the building of a mountain belt,
right,
like the Andes, you'll go out there for anything between a month or 2 months. Like in my PhD, we were out in the field for 2 months, and you were collecting vast quantities of data every day because you had to build the fundamental framework of what the rocks look like over that different length and scale. And you then have to collect samples that allow you to do more detailed analysis. So it can literally be from hours to years worth of effort in the case of a PhD.
So have you traveled a lot working as a geologist? You know, what kind of places have you been? You said you've been to near the Red Sea and then...
Yeah. No, I've been traveled a lot, yep. So been to Borneo a number of times, been to Egypt a number of times, northern Spain, Andes as well. So we're going to the Andes again later this year, which we're very excited about. Hopefully down to South Africa as well.
So you'd recommend the career of a geologist if you're interested in travel?
It's really good for bonus points for airlines, right?
But right,
in some
okay.
other ways, it's difficult from a personal and professional perspective to travel to have to travel for your work. It's hugely enjoyable, but you know, when we're out in the field, it's not easy. You know, it's kind of early mornings, late nights. It's a lot of like a logistical effort to get there. So it is spectacular. I would not recommend it to somebody, but it is challenging at times.
And so you were actually involved with some work with the BBC where you were doing a documentary.
Yeah.
And how was that to do? Because were you actually doing scientific work, you know, out there? Did you get papers out of this, or was this kind of a different kind of public awareness campaign?
It was. weirdly enough, in Expedition Volcano, the BBC Two show, I was not one of the scientists. I was one of the presenters.
Oh, right.
So the scientists were people like Kayleigh Iacovino. There was a number of people who were in that show who were the BBC scientists, and then there were presenters. And so my job was to act as a kind of go-between the people trying to do the science there and investigate the behaviour and structure of this volcano, and then the public who wanted to try and understand some of the things they were doing. So my job was to link between those two different sets.
Obviously, that was good because you had the experience on the working on the geological side, which helps.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, at times I was pining to be more hands-on with the science, as you could imagine, right? Because you're out there with people with equipment, they're doing this really cool stuff, and I felt like I had to kind of not learn my lines, but I was trying to keep a bit of distance from the hardcore science so I could use a language which was accessible to people who didn't really use it all the time.
Yeah, so let's go back to the hardcore science.
Yeah.
You were talking before about getting ideas from fieldwork, but also a lot of what you're doing is doing kind of remote sensing work. And trying to figure out what's underground by not digging a big hole. So how does that work? What kind of stuff do you do, and how does it work?
Yeah, so one of the key techniques we use is called seismic reflection imaging, because a lot of geology is contained under our feet. Not all rocks have been brought out of the earth in mountains, for example, and are available for us to go and look at in the field. So some of them are still contained deep in the earth, and we need a way of looking at that. We use this technique called seismic reflection imaging, where we let off a big bang, and sound energy travels down into the earth. It bounces back off the rock layers, and then we record the sound coming back using geophones or hydrophones if it's at sea or if it's on land. From that, we get an image of the Earth's subsurface. So it's effectively like X-raying the Earth, and we can build up a relatively detailed picture of what the layers look like in the rocks and the thickness of those layers and the structures, the faults and the folds. So yeah, that's one of the ways we kind of remote sense the Earth.
And so you kind of set off a big explosion, and this is just like literally an explosion?
Well, on land, people tend not to use dynamite anymore for obvious reasons, but back in the good old days, you could do that. Nowadays, you'd probably use something like a truck that would drop a large weight or something that would vibrate on the back of a truck, and that would be the source of the energy. At sea, it's an air gun, so it's something which is towed behind the boat, and it releases a big sort of pulse, a bubble pulse into the water. So that's the energy.
Oh, right. And the collapse of the bubble is like a shockwave.
Exactly, yeah. So we have different sources depending on whether it's a marine or a land acquisition.
And I mean, how good can these images be? What's the kind of, can you see, can you really see things underground, or is there a bit of, manipulation and kind of, you have to know what you're looking at to get there?
Yeah, my eyes are lighting up now because some of the images I'm seeing, like even today and like I saw yesterday, are just incredible what we can see. We have imaging which allows us to see things a few meters in dimension, and these are buried a few hundreds of meters beneath or even down to a few kilometers beneath the seabed. Obviously, the image quality deteriorates due to the attenuation of the energy going into the Earth, so you're losing some of that energy deeper down. So your image at depth is typically fuzzier than your image near the seabed in a marine acquisition, for example.
Right.
So you've got better resolution up top, but it's just unbelievable how it's revolutionized how we understand what the Earth looks like under our feet. I mean, I've kind of been fortunate enough to be born to be working in a time when these data are becoming much more readily available.
It's amazing. It's amazing that you can get meter resolution, hundreds of meters underground. That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we're going to go on to your third song. You've chosen Ill Manners by Plan B. Any particular reason for this one?
Listen to the lyrics. Very kind of hard-hitting, very unforgiving lyrics. Just an awesome sort of unusual beat and an instrumentation. I just absolutely love this song.
Let's all go on an urban safari. We might see some illegal migrants. Oi, look, there's a chap, that means council house and violent. He's got a hoodie on, give him a hug. A second thought, don't, you don't want to get mugged. Oh shit, too late, that was kind of dumb. Whose idea was that? Stupid, he's got some front. Hey, for you, be the joker, play the fool. Politics, ain't it all? Smoke and mirrors, April Fools. All year round, all in all, just another brick in the wall. Get away with murder in the schools. Use four letter swear words, cause we're cool. All drinkers, drug takers, every single one of us run the earth. Keep on believing what you're reading the papers. Council estate is gone with the earth. Thinking of a life on the council estate is from a thing you've ever read about it or heard. But it's all true, so save the estate.
Oh, so the movement of plates creates three different types of tectonic boundaries. Convergent, where plates move into one another. Divergent, where plates move apart. And transform, where plates move sideways in relation to one another. Now, I'm sure that's a bit of an oversimplification, and there's probably far more than that. But but that's our third fact. That's close enough, right? Yes,
no, it's absolutely perfect.
Brilliant. So, because we actually have a little demonstration, and that you're going to show us how a particular kind of rock formation develops. And what do we have in front of us, and what are we about to do?
We have sand, and we in a container. I'll just open that up. So we have some relatively fine grained sand, and we also have some aloe vera washing up liquid.
I don't think it needs to be aloe vera. That, I don't think it specifies.
Other washing up liquid.
Exactly, kind of that thing. And so this is going to show us how we form a diapir. Is that the right?
I think that's what we're going to try and do here. So in this kind of experiment, we have the aloe vera would be the analog for salt. So
right.
Diapirs are when rock, because rock can flow. Salt rock can flow like a liquid. Yeah, like a viscous fluid. So this is going to be our analog for salt, and the sand will be the analog for the kind of rocks above it, or the sediment deposited above it. So the overburden, we call it. So,
right. Okay.
And I have a bowl as well, which.
So we've got a bowl, and if it's clear on the sides, it means that you can actually
see
what's kind of going on underneath.
Yeah.
So why don't you take us through what we're doing.
So what we're going to do is we've got the bowl. I'm going to take the lid off the washing up liquid and fill the bowl, or kind of pour a lot of that into the bowl. So that's kind of gloopy, the washing up liquid. And that is, like I say, the salt analog. And then what we're going to do, let me see, is let that settle out. So, and that's like a bright green colour. And then I'm going to put the salt on top. And then I'm going to see if we can get the salt to become denser than the washing up liquid, and so that it sinks or subsides into the washing up liquid, and then the washing up liquid will rise relative to the sand, creating diapirs. That's the plan. So I'm going to.
So we're just like sprinkling the sand now over the top of the washing up liquid,
and I can see that it's coating it quite evenly. But what I'm going to do now is put more sand, and already, yep, that's great. So what's happening now is the sand has kind of created a mound, and where the sand is thickest, it's sinking down into the washing up liquid because it's denser. But on the other side of the bowl, where there's less sand, that sand is staying on the surface because it's less dense. What's very, very cool is we've had some diapirs rise. So the washing up liquid has actually risen up and is actually now flowing over some of the thin sand area, being driven by the subsiding thick sand.
All right, and so this is like something we actually see in nature, right?
Yep, so one of the bits of research I'm really obsessed about, along with lots of other things, is salt tectonics. So lots of sedimentary basins on Earth, so where sediments are preserved, are in salt provinces, where you have not washing up liquid, but you actually have something called halite, which actually flows when you bury it and differentially pressure it. This is really cool.
It's working quite well.
Absolutely, yes.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I'm slightly surprised at how well our little demonstration.
It's really good.
It's actually working. Yeah. Is this kind of similar to the things that you would actually do in a geology lab? These kind of simulations are done, and what kind of insights can they give you?
Yeah, so physical analog modelling is a really powerful tool in many areas of earth sciences, because we manage to scale the earth down into our labs, and then we have a lot more control in terms of playing with the parameter space that give rise to a series of geological structures we see in the field or in seismic data in the subsurface. So, you know, often the earth is messy because we are left with the final structure and we don't really know. We have to unwind how it got to that point. And that unwinding is not easy, and it's not often unique in terms of the solution. So physical models give us a good idea of what physical properties, the mechanics that are plausible, that will give rise to the kinematics, i.e. how the thing moves, and then the final structure. So, absolutely what we do in earth sciences.
And that means you can play with the parameters as well. You can make something, you know, a bit thinner or a bit thicker and then change and see that that gives different formations.
Yeah, so exactly. The washing up liquid experiment, we'd use silicon.
Right.
But we could actually change the rheology of the silicon by mixing sand or something else into it and making it more viscous.
Right.
And then we could see what would happen in a case where the salt was more viscous than this example we're doing here on the desk.
And then this obviously happens over a much shorter time scale.
Yeah, yeah.
As an analog to kind of millions of years.
I'm old, but not that old.
It would be a long, long experiment.
Yes, exactly.
There have been some that have been going on for 100 years, but I don't think we do that well there.
No.
Okay, so we're going to go on to your fourth song, which is The Futureheads with Hounds of Love.
Oh, who doesn't like The Hounds of Love anyway by Kate Bush? But The Futureheads just managed to do something absolutely amazing in a rehash of a song and just made it brilliant even more. And again, listen to the intonations and the accents. It's just wonderful. I absolutely love this song as well.
The oldest known sedimentary rock formation is on Aquila Island in southwest Greenland. The rocks there are 3.9 billion years old.
Science. News.
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 Rogue asteroid heading the wrong way. Memories in RNA transferred between sea slugs. Well, that's it. I'm on my own this week, so we've only got a couple of science news stories to let you know about. Both of these I found very, very interesting. The first one is about a rogue asteroid heading the wrong way. And so this is two astronomers called Fathi Noumani in the Côte d'Azur in Nice in France, and Helen Morais of the Universidade Estadual Paulista de Rio Claro, Brazil, that was my best Portuguese accent, have actually used computer simulations to show that this asteroid, which is known as 2015 BZ subscript 509, you'll agree a very easy to remember and interesting name, they've done some simulations. They've shown that the asteroid, which is kind of close to Jupiter in terms of the size of its orbit, but it's actually been traveling the wrong way around the sun. So all of the planets and all of the asteroids that we observe all go the same way round the sun. And that's because they think that the formation of these planets was to do with in the infant solar system was kind of one big cloud of things that have all started spinning around. And they then from that spinning cloud kind of formed into their own planets. And this one's going the wrong way. So this means that one of the best explanations for this is that it's actually it's come here from another star's planetary system. So it's an alien asteroid that has been caught in our orbit, which is kind of amazing that there is an asteroid out there that's come from another solar system. And maybe if we could one day go and find it, we might be able to find out a little bit about another solar system just by looking in our own, which is kind of amazing. Another one is that apparently, this is memories in RNA transferred between sea slugs. Now, this is kind of fascinating. So, obviously, most scientists and most people in general think that long-term memories are in the brain. They're to do with rerunning of neural pathways in the brain, and they get reinforced, and that becomes a long-term memory. But there's some results published by Dan Glasman and a team at UCLA. They level the competing argument that maybe some types of RNA molecules are actually the things that contain memory. So it's not the linkages between nerve cells, it's actually what gets put into RNA. And so the reason they think this is because they took some sea slugs, and these sea slugs are called Aplysia californica, and apparently they have a little like water siphoning appendage, which water filtering that they call their siphon, and they put it in if it's you know, vulnerable to a predator. And Glansman used electric shocks to kind of reinforce this siphon withdrawal response, and then extracted RNA from those sea slugs and injected it into other sea slugs that hadn't been sensitized, and then they showed the same long-lasting kind of withdrawal response to the shocked companion. So in this way, the memory of like being shocked and what to modifying its behavior was transferred from one sea slug to another, which is just kind of bonkers, really. It's, you know, we thought the memory resides in one place, and actually it resides in a completely different one. That's pretty fascinating. Okay, so we're going to go on to your next song,
okay,
which is Fool's Gold by the Stone Roses.
Yeah. Do I need to explain why?
You don't have to explain why. You can just be like, this is an awesome song. And if that's your reason, then we'll just listen to it.
Oh, it's just perfect.
August 28, 1859, George Bizzle and Edwin L. Drake made the first successful use of a drilling rig on a well drilled especially to produce oil at a site on Oil Creek near Tootsville, Pennsylvania. So that's our fifth fact, and actually it applies because one of the applications of your work is in the petrochemical industry. We have limited resources and it's getting more difficult to extract. What does what you do apply and how does it help?
Well, the way we, you know, hope our work helps in that area is in when we think about oil exploration, if we can drill with more confidence to find hydrocarbons, we then need to drill less wells. We can drill smarter. Also, once we've found hydrocarbons, in terms of producing those hydrocarbons, if we understand what the structure and the rock layers in the earth look like, we can then produce those hydrocarbons more efficiently and therefore need less wells to produce the found hydrocarbons. So we'd like to, you know, our understanding of the structure and stratigraphy, the rock layers in the earth is applied towards finding it better and to producing it better.
There's always kind of an argument that there's, you know, we're running out of oil. Do you think are we going to get to a point where you can't extract things anymore? Or, I've always heard the argument, you know, there's 50 years of oil left, but there's maybe 50 years of oil with current technologies. Is that going to keep going, or is there a hard end?
There's a hard end in terms of the Earth has produced a certain given finite quantity of hydrocarbons, right?
Yeah.
I think that number's very big.
Yeah.
Technology certainly has a role to play in terms of making hard to extract oil or hard to find oil easier to extract and find. There's also clearly geopolitical issues around this. There's hydrocarbons which we know are there, but it's hard to get to for lots of geopolitical reasons. There's purely economic reasons. At the moment, the taxation regime in country X or Y is such that it's not economic for a company to go in and produce only 10 million barrels there, because they're looking at it from a global portfolio point of view. But for the local people there, as a local energy source, if those hydrocarbons could be produced, that would be useful for them for, you know, a few decades. So
yeah.
There's all those dynamics around that question of how much do we have left. I think what I would say as a punchline is there's probably more than people think, and there's probably more issues surrounding that question than people probably intuitively think about. The people often just think about the Earth has only produced a certain amount of hydrocarbons.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously there's a lot of stuff about producing hydrocarbons and affecting climate change, and we are inevitably kind of winding down our production.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think like your research plays a role in other things that are maybe built in with that. I'm thinking of stuff like, you know, carbon storage, yep, and that sort of thing. How does that apply?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, full disclosure, I'm a complete environmentalist. I'm a complete lefty. A lot of all of my sort of feelings about the research we do is all, like I say, with an aim of drilling less wells to do the things actually at this moment in time, we still need. Looking forward to the future, carbon capture and storage is definitely an area where the hydrocarbon industry and academics like me can play a role, because some of the techniques we're using to find and extract hydrocarbons and some of the techniques we're using for our research can definitely be applied to more intelligently choosing sites for CCS and storing material in those sites, the carbon in those sites. So yeah, absolutely.
And one of the other things I'm just interested, there's lots of, you know, we're looking to build kind of solar cells and batteries and that sort of things. They also need other resources that are in the ground, you know, rare earths and that sort of thing. How does any of what you're doing apply to kind of finding those things, or is that a different?
I mean, most of the rare earth stuff, you're probably still thinking about a lot of geochemistry. You're still thinking, though, about using fundamental geological mapping, right? So you find a resource and you have to map it using some techniques, be that kind of in-field mapping or be it subsurface mapping using mine shafts and things. So some of the really basic techniques we teach undergraduates are still really relevant to finding rare earth elements. In terms of my research, not directly, because I think I'm doing a lot of stuff already, but
so, yeah,
maybe there is an application for some of it.
But so a lot of what you're doing is just kind of fundamental, like getting an understanding of how the Earth got to where it is. Is that, you think, what drives you to do this research? Is that, or, you know, where does it come from? Is it just curiosity?
Yeah, curiosity. A lot of curiosity about how the Earth forms. Or how it deforms and like the processes occurring on it. And then also I'd like to think that some of the work has an applied value to the, you know, the moment, to the hydrocarbon industry, maybe in the future to CCS. I'd like to think I'm making a material contribution to society and not just keeping myself off the street by doing something I personally enjoy, which, you know, is not wrong. And absolutely, we need inquiry and we need to be inquisitive about things and to be passionate about just finding stuff out. I just really enjoy the fact that some of my work might be valuable to people.
Well, it absolutely is valuable. And thank you very much for coming on.
No problem.
We're gonna finish off by getting the answer to our brain teaser. So the question was, the object has holes in its top and bottom, sides and insides. Despite this, it can hold water. What am I? Do you have any guesses here in the studio? What do we think? No?
I'm so bad at these sorts of brains.
Well, okay, so the answer is a sponge. Because it's got holes on the sides and top and bottom and outside, but it can still hold water. So there you go. So I would like to thank Professor Chris Jackson for coming on the show. And if people want to find you on social media, find out a little bit more about your research, where can they go? How can they find that out?
So my Twitter handle is @SizeMatters. Size is spelled like seismic, not like sizes in size. It's SEIS_matters. So follow me there and I tweet about lots of different stuff.
Brilliant. So remember, you can check out all our previous shows on your trusty podcast provider. Let us know if you like the show. You can get in touch on @ScienceMixtape and all the relevant channels. We're actually going to play out with Led Zeppelin. Why this one, Chris?
Growing up as a black kid in Derby, you know, liking rock and roll was kind of an unusual look. But it was something my dad used to play in a band, so he was into Led Zeppelin. So I absolutely love this. And also, you probably have detected I'm a bit of a freak for a bass line, right?
I did hear that.
Just listen to this one. I absolutely love it.
All right. Well, here's a Led Zeppelin with Black Dog. And thank you and goodbye. Thank you.